The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's get started with the Reader's Digest. And we'll start off with a letter for this is the first Tuesday in May, a letter from our editor, Bruce Kelly. Meeting our hero. Matt Cohen's first thought out of the car was, why would I want to be outside the car? Yet he and his buddy had planned to walk 1.3 miles up Camelback Mountain, just as every hiker visiting Phoenix does. So up the trail they started. Right away, everything felt off. Matt and his friend are young and proven backpackers, but every two or three steps they had to stop to drink. They were 45 minutes in, now barely moving, and their 8 quarts of water was almost gone. Time just slowed. From the around the bend came a lone hiker, bouncing down the trail with a knapsack on his back. Are you guys okay? He asked. Yeah, Matt said, lying. The man searched Matt's eyes. You look like you're about to pass out. Matt stared back at him, his dehydrated brain barely working. I know that face, he thought. Amazingly, he did. Matt had seen a video about the guy right on his desk at Reader's Digest. Matt is our associate photo editor, and he had recently searched for a picture of a man devoted to saving hikers from the sneak-up-on-you heat of Camelback. We had read about him and wanted to put him on the magazine. Now the hero was in front of Matt, and it was Matt who needed saving. Scott Cullimore guided Matt and his friend to a rocky seat. Then he pulled chilled bottles of Poland Spring from his jury-rigged insulated pack. Only then, sitting, did Matt realize, wow, he's right. I'm not doing well. As he came to his senses, Matt eventually remembered he had his camera, his impromptu photograph of Scott at our story run on page 10, which we'll get to soon. I don't know what to say, Matt reflected afterwards. I talk to everyday heroes a lot for my job, but to get help from one, it made the kindness and the heroism all so real. 50 health facts your doctor wants you to know. Thanks for a great list of facts and myths regarding the number 34. About rinsing after brushing your teeth. I found a good way to extend fluoride benefits. Floss after brushing before rinsing. It's a little messy, but it gets the fluoride into the tight spaces between teeth. And these are letters to the editor, by the way. We found a fix. I am the communion lady at my church, and part of that responsibility includes washing and ironing the communion cloth, hanging it on a hanger, even one padded with a towel left a crease in it. I tried your tip of using bubble wrap to pad the hanger. Holy Communion, it worked. No more creases. Bless you. A 5-year-old teaches a lesson in grace. I so much of myself in this author, as I am dealing with the effects of dementia overtaking my mother. I can relate to how hard it is to handle the continuous phone calls and the guilt and fear because I have yelled at her and am so scared of getting older myself. This article brought me to tears and help me realize that I am not the only one who has felt this way, and I will get through it. Thank you for sharing this kind of story. Dumb and Dumber on the Job. I especially enjoy the excuses for missing work. When Julius Caesar had qualms on the Ides of March about going to the Senate, where he will be assassinated, his wife suggested, "We'll send Mark Antony to the Senate House, and he'll say that you're sick today." They were making that excuse way back then, before they were stars. There's another real James Bond, an ornithologist who wrote the definitive book, Birds of the West Indies. Ian Fleming was a bird watcher living in Jamaica. In a letter, he offered Bond unlimited use of the name Ian Fleming, included using it to christen particularly horrible species of bird, should he discover one. Everyday Heroes. I have essential tremors, so I understand the problem of unsteady hands. Fortunately, I found a place that will do my nails for me. Kudos to Ebony. We need more people like her. The Internet chump who became a champ. Being a missionary in Asia with my husband, I can say that God does amazing things through people who have a heart to care about others. I was encouraged and blessed to have read this article and will share it with others. The Perfect Brain Food. I had a mom who always used to tell me to put my book down and get outside. One day her sister-in-law heard her and said I would give anything if I could get Michael, her son, to pick up a book. That was the last time Mom complained about my reading. A Timeless Wolf Tale. Please do not wait another 32 years to republish My Friend the Timber Wolf, the story that originally appeared in your May 1987 issue. Every generation of your readers should be exposed to this story. I feel blessed because I once stared into the eyes of a wild wolf in Montana. What a sight to behold. And now let's read about the everyday hero that was mentioned when we first started out. When Mother Nature's dangerous heat sneaks up on unaware hikers, this resourceful local comes to the rescue. And there's a picture of Scott Cullimore holding out a bottle of cold water, standing on a cliff edge. And he's looks like he's probably in his 30s, maybe early 40s. Brown hair, tall and slender. He's wearing a t-shirt and a blue t-shirt and blue, light blue and dark blue shorts, and obviously hiking shoes. The Water Angel. Even if you've never been to Phoenix, you know this about the place. It's hot. From June to September, the temperature can easily eclipse the century mark. But that doesn't stop hikers from attempting the 1.3-mile trek to the top of the city's famed Camelback Mountain. Signs warn that the trail is extremely difficult. If you continue, a posted checklist suggests at least a liter of water per person. And if you're still not deterred, another sign farther up declares, if you're halfway through your water, turn around. Unfortunately, many people do not heed the warnings. Fortunately, Scott Cullimore does. When he's not running his carpet cleaning company in nearby Mesa, the 53-year-old Cullimore can be found hiking up and down Camelback a couple times a day, doling out cold bottles of water to worn-out hikers. He has helped hydrate so many hikers that he has earned a heavenly nickname, the Water Angel. I'd like a more manly name, but you know, he calmly told AsFamily.com. Cullimore was on Camelback Mountain one day in 2015. Excuse me, I have to turn a page here. When a British tourist died after being lost for nearly 6 hours in the July heat. That experience inspired him to start helping people caught unaware by Arizona's unforgiving version of Mother Nature. They underestimated the mountain, and they overestimated what they can do. And they get themselves in trouble, he told the Arizona Republic. If a hiker has a flushed face and is not sweating anymore, Cullimore says, he reaches into his insulated orange backpack, pulls out a frosty bottle, and hands it to the person. It's nothing for him to go through 8 waters, which he pays for himself, and 1 lap up and down the mountain. It's misleading that we're in the middle of the city. You can die up here, and no one would know. One hiker availed himself of the proffered water grease. You think you know the heat, and then you get out here in the desert, and it surrounds you like a blanket, said Austin Hill, who was hiking with a high school friend. They were lucky, he said, pointing to Cullimore. We ran into this good Samaritan here. And with that, the Water Angel goes in search of another hiker in need. How about a little levity after that rather serious but pleasant article? Laugh lines. My husband is so good at home repairs that they have a special VIP area for him in the emergency room. My girlfriend wants to stain the new wooden fence in her backyard, so I'm going to eat spaghetti over it for a few weeks. Movies show people kissing in the rain, but I want a guy who run out there and get the cushions off the porch chairs when the weather starts kicking up. Ordered a bed from IKEA, and they sent me a tree trunk and a saw. Everybody's a tough guy until they have to use a screwdriver overhead for 2 minutes. Oh, that's so true. Please don't come to my garage sale if you've ever let me borrow something from you. The Library, a Love Story. The magic of these books-lined buildings, palaces, really, filled my childhood with delight. Parenthood helped me experience that bliss again. I grew up in libraries, or at least it feels that way. I was raised in the suburbs of Cleveland, just a few blocks from the brick-faced Bertram Woods branch of the Shaker Heights Public Library System. I went there several times a week with my mother. She and I would walk in together. As soon as we passed through the door, we each headed for our favorite section. The library might have been the first place I was ever given autonomy. For even when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, I was allowed to head off on my own. Then, after a while, my mother and I would reunite at the checkout counter with our finds. Together we'd wait as the librarian pulled out the date card and stamped it with the checkout machine. That giant fist thumping the card with a hard, loud thunk, chunk, chunk, printing a crooked due date underneath a score of previous crooked due dates that belonged to other people, other times. And there's a picture of the author here. It looks like it's back in the 50s, because I see a 1958 Ford behind her. The author at home in Beechwood, Ohio, where she discovered her love of books. It's a young girl, cute girl, dark hair, wearing a coat and looks like a jumper. These visits were dreamy, fictionless interludes that promised I would leave richer than I'd arrived. It wasn't like I was going to a store with my mom, which guaranteed a tug of war between what I wanted and what my mother was willing to buy me. In the library, I could have anything I wanted. After we checked out, I loved being in the car and having all the books we'd gotten stacked on my lap, pressing me under their solid, warm weight, the Mylar cover sticking a bit to my thighs. It was such a thrill leaving a place with things you hadn't paid for, such a thrill anticipating the new books we would read. On the ride home, my mom and I talked about the order in which we would go in to read our books, a solemn conversation in which we planned how to pace ourselves through this charmed, effervescent period of grace and that the books were due. When I was older, I usually walked to the library by myself, lugging back as many books as I could carry. Occasionally, I did go with my mother, and for the trip would be enchanted as it had been when I was small. Even when I was in my last year of high school and could drive myself to the library, my mother and I still went together now and then, and the trip unfolded exactly as it had when I was a child, with all the same beats and pauses and comments and reveries, the same perfect, pensive rhythm we'd followed so many years before. When I miss my mother these days, since she died 2 years ago, I like to picture us in the car together, going for a more magnificent trip to Burnham Woods. My parents valued books, but they grew up in the Depression, aware of the quicksilver nature of money, and they had learned the hard way that you wouldn't buy what you could borrow. Because of that frugality, or perhaps independent of it, they also believed that you read a book for the experience of reading it. You didn't read it in order to have an object that had to be housed and looked after forever, a memento of the purpose for which it was obtained. The reading of the book was a journey. There was no need for souvenirs. And then we have another set of pictures. Also, once again, looks like it's in the 50s, with a mother and two daughters, and looks like a couple boys in the front seat. Our uncrowded bookshelves at home had several sets of encyclopedias, an example of something not convenient to borrow from the library, since you reached for it regularly and urgently, and an assortment of other books that, for one reason or another, my parents had ended up with. There were some travel guides, some coffee table books, a few of my father's law books, and a dozen or so novels that were either gifts or somehow managed to justify being owned outright. When I left for college, one of the many ways I differentiated myself from the parents was that I would wild for owning books. I think buying textbooks was what got me going. All I know is that I lost my appreciation for the slow pace of making your way through a library and for having books on borrowed time. As soon as I got my own apartment, I lined it with bookshelves and loaded them with hard covers. I turned into a ravenous buyer of books. I loved the alkaline tang of new ink and paper, a smell that never emanated from broken-in library book. I loved the crack of newly flexed spine and the way the brand new pages felt almost damp, as if they were wet with creation. Sometimes I fantasized about starting a bookstore. If my mother ever mentioned to me that she was in the waiting list for some books at the library, I got annoyed and asked why she didn't just go buy it. I might have spent the rest of my life thinking about libraries only wistfully, the way I thought about, say, the amusement park I went to as a kid. Libraries might have become just a bookmark of memory more than an actual place, a way to call up an emotion of a moment that occurred long ago, something that was fused with mother and the past in my mind. But in 2011, my husband accepted a job in Los Angeles, so we left New York and headed west. My son was in first grade when we moved. One of his first school assignments was to interview someone who worked for the city. I suggested talking to a garbage collector or a police officer, but he said he wanted to interview a librarian. We were so new to town that we had to look up the address of the closest library, which was the Los Angeles Public Library Studio City Branch. It was about a mile away from our house, about the same distance that the Bertram Woods branch had been from my childhood home. As my son and I drove to meet the librarian, I was floored by the sense of absolute familiarity, a gut-level recollection of this journey of parent and child on their way to the library. I'd taken this trip so many times before, but now it was turned on its head, and I was the parent bringing my child on that special trip. We parked, and my son and I walked to the library. Take it in for the first time. The building was white and modish, with a mint-green mushroom cap of a roof. From the outside, it didn't look anything like the stout brick Bertram Woods branch, but when we stepped in, the thunderbolt of recognition struck me so hard that it made me gasp. Decades had passed, and I was 2,000 miles away, but I felt as if I had been whisked back to that precise time and place, walking into the library with my mother. And there's a picture of the author. She has reddish hair. She's very attractive, tall and slender. Nothing had changed. There was the same soft tisk-tisk of pencil on paper, and the muffling murmuring from the patrons at the tables at the center of the room, and the creak and groan of book carts, and the occasional papery chunk of a book dropped on a desk. The scarred wooden checkout counters, and the librarian's desk as big as boats, and the bulletin board with its fluttering, raggedy notices were all the same. The sense of general, steady busyness, like a pot of water on a rolling boil, was just the same. The books on the shelves, with some subtractions and additions, were certainly the same. It wasn't that time stopped in the library. It was as if we were captured here, collected here, and in all libraries, and not only in my time, my life, but in all humanity time as well. In the library, time is dammed up, not just stopped, but saved. The library is a gathering pool of narratives and the people who come in to find it. It is where we glimpse immortality. In the library, we can live forever. So the spell that libraries had once cast on me was renewed. Maybe it had never really been broken, although I had been away long enough that it was like visiting a country I'd loved, but had forgotten as my life went galloping by. I knew that part what hooked me had been the shock of familiarity I felt when I took my son to our local library. The way it telegraphed my childhood, my relationship to my parents, my love of books, it brought me close in my musings to my mother and to our sojourns in the library. It was a wonderful and it was bittersweet, because just as I was rediscovering those memories, my mother was losing all of hers. When I first told her that I was writing a book about libraries, she was delighted and said that she was proud of she'd had a part in making me find them wondrous. But soon, the dark fingers of dementia got her in their grip, and they pried loose bits of her memory every day. The next time I reminded her about the project and told her how much I had been thinking about our trips to Bertram Woods, she smiled with encouragement, but with no apparent recognition of what I meant. Each time I visited, she receded a little more. She became vague, absent, isolated in her thoughts, or maybe in some pillowy blankness that filled in where the memories had been chipped away, and I knew that I was carrying the remembrance for both of us. The writer Armandan Hampante Ba once said that in Africa, when an old person dies, it is like a library has burned. When I first heard the phrase, I didn't understand it, but over time I came to realize it was perfect. Our minds and souls contain volumes inscribed by our experiences and emotions. Each individual's consciousness is a collection of memories we've cataloged and stored inside us. A private library of a life lived. It is something that no one else can entirely share. It burns down and disappears when we die. But if you can take something from your internal collection and share it with one person or with the larger world of the page on a story told, it takes on a life of its own. And that's the end of that article. And then we have the dinosaur capital of the world, New Jersey. The Garden State be best known for the Turnpike and the Boss. But paleontologists say it's New Jersey's fossils that really deserve top billing. The world's first substantial dinosaur skeleton was found in Haddonfield in 1858, and a few years after that, scientists dug up the first Tyrannosaurus remains in nearby Mantua Township. Humor in uniform. It was basic training, and I was seated in the barber chair, bemoaning the impending loss of my hair, when the barber asked, "Where are you from?" "St. Louis," I grumbled. "Hey, I'm from St. Louis, too," he said. He then asked for conspiratorially, "Do you want to keep your sideburns?" I perked up, "Sure." With that, he revved up the razor, clipped off my sideburns, and gave them to me. As I left the barber shop with sideburns in hand, I heard him ask the next victim, "Where are you from?" "Chicago." "Hey, I'm from Chicago, too." doing KP duty, my sergeant ordered me to prepare 100 gallons of soup for the night's dinner. When I told him I had no clue how to make soup, he handed me a cookbook and instructed, follow the directions carefully. Not long after, I had a large kettle of soup simmering. The sergeant came in, grabbed a spoon, and took a taste. This is really good, he said. Are you sure you followed the recipe? Drama in real life. Death rattle. There was no warning, just a silent and deadly bite in a remote area of Yosemite. An anti-venom was 100 miles away, and there's a picture of a rattlesnake with its tongue out, coiled and ready to strike. Our son, Bridger, was 2 weeks old when my wife, Turin, and I decided to take a road trip. 2 weeks later, we bought a 1988 Ford Transvan, a converted RV that we dubbed the Queen, and left our home in Los Alamos, New Mexico. I had grown up in Oregon, camping or hiking, and canoeing every weekend with my parents and older brother Garrett. At 33, I had worked as a wildlife firefighter and as a filmmaker, traveling the world making adventure TV. I stepped on a deadly viper in Belize, been held up by a gorilla with AK-47s in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and dodged a snapping crocodile in Papua New Guinea. Somehow, loose bowels had been my worst affliction. Turin's lust for adventure matched mine. Since our wedding 7 years before, she had taken 14 international trips, some for her work as a researcher at Los Alamos National Laboratory, but mostly for fun. Fun for her is rafting 145 miles through the Alaskan wilderness, which she did her first trimester. On our road trip, we shivered in Canyonlands National Park, went canyoneering in Utah's San Rafael Swell, and surfed on the Oregon coast. Bridger wasn't smiling yet, but we have photos of him in the West's most spectacular places looking, as we interpret his expression, happy. He stayed that way until a few days before we reached Yosemite National Park, where we would meet up with my family on the last stop of our month-long trip. Then he got a little colicky. And there's a picture of the author and his wife. He's good-looking, got reddish hair, rather handsome young man, and she's got a real big grin on her face. Can't tell what color her hair is because she's got a big cap on. My brother has lived in El Porto, California, near Yosemite, for about 7 years. Garrett manages the park's vegetation, all 748,436 acres. His wife, Erin, is also a botanist. My recently retired parents had moved into their RV, which was parked in Garrett and Erin's driveway when we arrived. We spent that first night passing Bridger around and telling stories. The next morning, April 23rd, broke warm enough to hear shorts, and Garrett suggested a family walk into the wildflowers above town. They're peaking, he said. We climbed for 3 miles through meadows and granite blocks toward the 50-foot-high Foretta Falls. It felt like hiking through Renoir. Garrett and Erin named off blooms in all colors, and we snapped pictures of the valley. At 11:45 a.m., we reached a bridge that crossed a waterfall. Bridger chirped his need for milk and turned stopped to nurse him. Erin was the only one besides me who saw the snake. Brown and big is how she remembers it. I remember seeing a dust-red coil in the new grass. But to me, the snake was more of a sensation, a light tap just above the sock on my right ankle. Then I passed out. When I awoke a minute or two later, after I'd finished my first bout of violent vomiting, I heard my parents talking through the options to get me out. My mom had been an emergency room nurse and a physician assistant for 35 years. She and my dad had conducted some 700 missions as volunteers for the search and rescue team in Bend, Oregon. Neither had ever dealt with a rattlesnake bite. I didn't know it then, but the rule about rattlesnake bites is time is tissue. How many minutes or hours elapse before you get a dose of antivenom determines your fate. An afternoon in the ER, if help comes quickly, amputation if a bite goes untreated for a few hours, or perhaps in my case, death on a remote stone bridge. We had no cell service to call for help, so Garrett took off running back toward El Portal, about 3.5 miles away. He'd run about a half mile before he was able to call 911. The dispatcher ordered a rescue helicopter and an ambulance, then asked Garrett to run about 2 miles to the town of Foresta, where he could meet with an incoming paramedics and guide them to me. I threw up every few minutes, in intensifying waves. Rivulets of blood, thinned by the venom, ran from the puncture wounds. My leg burned. I felt the same way after I had eaten bad fish in Laos, except I was terrified. Get Bridger out of here, I told Turin. I couldn't stand the thought of him watching me die. She carried him down the road and watched from a distance as I gripped my parents' hands. At 11:45 a.m., there's a picture of a parents and a picture of his leg with the fang bites in it. Garrett had sprinted about a mile when he reached Crane Creek, but it was flooded, and the bridge was burned out except for four steel girders, each about 8 inches wide and 45 feet long. They were wet and shaking from the thundering water 20 feet below. My brother isn't reckless. He is calculating, confident, and experienced, all of which had little to do with the when he decided to cross anyway. "You were actively dying," he told me later, so he sat down on one of the girders and scooted across. He ran more than 2 miles in 19 minutes. That included the bridge crossing. Within minutes of Garrett's 911 call, Jason Montoya, a Yosemite Park Ranger who specializes in technical rescues for the entire elite Yosemite search and rescue, was in an ambulance speeding my way. To be safe, he'd ordered a second helicopter equipped with a hoist to get me out of the canyon, plus a team of volunteers to hike up from El Portal. Based on the coordinates Garrett gave him to dispatch, Montoya figured they'd need to fly me out of the canyon on the hoist-equipped helicopter, then transfer me to the rescue helicopter, which had paramedic on board. Best-case scenario, he thought, I'd be in the emergency room in an hour and a half, which might mean I'd get to keep my leg. During the busiest time of the year, there's a hoist-equipped helicopter stationed at Yosemite, but it wasn't scheduled to arrive for another week. Dispatch tried its usual backup, but it was off on another call. A second backup was sidelined with an oil leak. Just below Foresta, Garrett crossed back over Crane Creek on an intact bridge and met the ambulance. A fallen tree had blocked its path, and one wheel was stuck in the road's soft shoulder. The medics were scrambling to pull gear from the truck, IVs and inflatable backboard drugs and after other medical supplies. Garrett, Montoya, and two medics took off running with a bag of medical equipment. But then they reached the burned-out bridge. Montoya insisted they turn around rather than scoot across the girders, as Garrett had done. We couldn't take that risk, Montoya said. Instead, they ran more than a mile back up the hill they just descended and crossed on the upper bridge. Then they bushwhacked towards me across cliffs and through a half mile of waist-high poison oak. When they arrived, I was pale and sweating, moaning in pain. My mom had been rolling me from my back to my side to vomit or defecate. My blood, unable to clot, wept from the puncture wounds on the ankle. Bruising, a sign of internal hemorrhaging, had bloomed above my knee. One of the medics, Levi Yardley, ripped open his medical kit. During the summer, Yosemite stocks a small supply of antivenom, but the supply hadn't yet been restocked. Instead, he tossed my mom a blood pressure cuff and grabbed 1,000 liters of saline, a pill to stop the vomiting, and fentanyl, a powerful opioid painkiller. My mom, the ranking medical professional on the scene, drew the drugs into syringes, but when Yardley asked her to start an IV, she paused. I don't feel comfortable doing that, she said. I'm a PA, but I'm a mom first. So Yardley stuck a 16-gauge needle, essentially a medical railroad spike, into each of my arms. The drugs work. I hurt less and stopped purging, and the IV rehydrated me. Finally, at 1:11 p.m., approximately 80 minutes after I was bitten, a helicopter took off from Paso Robles, an hour and 45 minutes away. The team from El Porto loaded me into an inflatable backboard, and I mustered a smile when they put aviator sunglasses on me to protect my eyes. We even snacked a family photo with Turin, Bridger on her chest, giving a thumbs up and me looking like smiling death. When the helicopter was 20 minutes away, the team carried me to the helicopter pickup point. If we don't get him out of here now, we're going to have critical patient on our hands. And I don't have the meds to deal with him, Yardley told Montoya. The drugs had run their course, and my symptoms had returned. Then a bee stung my thigh. Panicking, I told him I was allergic. Yardley told somebody to get an EpiPen. Please don't, I plead, afraid the EpiPen could agitate the snake venom. Yardley gambled that if I hadn't gone into anaphylactic yet, I wouldn't. As the brush beat about the copter downdraft, a cable was lowered about 200 feet. I felt myself tugged up of the ground, and a surge of relief. As the thumping of the helicopter faded, Turin finally gave in to the dark flesh thought she had been going through, ignoring for the past 3 hours. She and my parents broke into sobs. Bridger didn't make a sound. He hadn't. Not a singing, calling cry since the bite. And there's a picture of him being wrapped in an inflatable backboard. They've got information on a wrap around his arm, and it shows a picture of the helicopter, and that's 3:15 p.m. Bill Hayes keeps a collection of snake bite kits in a display case outside his office at Southern California's Loma Linda University, where he's a biology professor and one of the country's leading authorities on snake bite treatments. There are dozens of kits. Some contain razors to cut the wound and let the venom leach out. Others have pumps to suck a bite dry or sulfide to sterilize it. That day in Yosemite, we didn't have one of these kits, which is probably just as well. None of them work, nor do any of the folk remedies people are still trying today, which include freezing the wound and slathering with motor oil. Antivenom, that's the only cure, Hayes told me when I went to see him 6 months after I was bitten. Today's antivenom isn't so different from what French scientist Albert Calumet delivered in the 1990s while working in Vietnam. When a flood pushed dozens of cobras into a nearby village, 40 people were bitten and 4 died. Calumet, who was a protege of Louis Pasteur, applied the same techniques his mentor using to produce vaccine for rabies and anthrax. He milked the cobras and injected tiny amounts of venom into horses. After a few weeks, Calumet extracted the horse blood and spun out the antibodies that targeted cobra venom. Snake bites killed more people back then, but the World Health Organization still considers them a global health crisis. Each year, snakes kill more than 81,000 people and maim hundreds of thousands more. Modern antivenom is still made in livestock, and while it has gotten more effective over time, it is mostly species-specific. In the United States, it's also outrageously expensive. A single vial can cost $18,000, and most victims require 4 to 6 vials. Many clinics and hospitals don't stock it, and it's rarely carried by search and rescue teams. After the helicopter touched down at Doctors Medical Center in Modesto, nurses wheeled me into the emergency room and cut off my shorts and shirt. Then they hooked me up to my first IV laced with antivenom. 5.5 hours had passed since my bite. Over the next 72 hours, I'd receive 18 vials of the life-saving antidote. Each of the half-dozen doctors I saw told me that this was either the first snake bite they'd ever seen or the worst. Poison control guided my case. My leg from toe to hip turned black and yellow and eventually swelled to more than twice its normal circumference. During my first day in the hospital, I received morphine every 2 hours, yet the pain remained too severe for me to sleep. It felt as though the nerves were popping on my leg. The orthopedic surgeon grew convinced that I had developed compartment syndrome, a side effect of swelling that cuts off circulation to extremities, and in the worst cases leads to amputation. Fixing it would require an only slightly less intrusive emergency surgery. Deep incisions along the length of my leg to relieve the pressure. The night nurse, John, was a 71-year-old Vietnamese vet who'd been bitten twice by rattlesnakes. He joked that I should have done what he did to survive, eat the snake that bit me. More gamey than fishy, he said. It was John who saved me from going under the knife. In the early morning, he found a pulse at the tip of my foot, a sign that I still had circulation, which is enough to keep the surgeons from operating. It took 4 days for me to move from a bed to a chair, 2 more to stand up, and 8 before the doctors released me. Until then, Turin, Bridger, and my parents stayed in Queen in the hospital parking lot. After I was released, it took 1 month for me to totally walk normally, and 6 months for the swelling of my leg to go down. And there's a picture of Turin and Bridger sitting next to the hospital bed holding his hand, and a picture of him in his chair with his leg elevated. In search of some kind of closure, the following September, Garrett and I revisited the bridge where I was bitten. This time we're joined by Robert Hartson, who edits the Hepatological Review, and Rob Grasso, a Yosemite Park ecologist. We find the pair dressed in safari gear, flipping over rocks and logs with a rake. Garrett and I strap on protective Kevlar chaps, as though we're preparing to disarm a car bomb. Hansen rolls his eyes when he sees us. "They don't want to bite you," he says, then wades deeper into the oak trees where he thinks he has heard a high-pitched buzz of a baby rattlesnake's rattle. We're here because the snake bite did more than scar my ankle. I feel fine physically, but I have consumed with an unfamiliar sense of vulnerability. To be snake bit also means to experience a period bad luck, which is what I've lived through since the ordeal. Shortly afterward, our dog, Bud, got hit by a car. He survived, but weeks later we had to put him down our other dog, 13-year-old Lucy. A friend sustained a severe concussion while we were biking. Another broke his neck skiing. Yet another lost his dad to a stroke. Plenty of good happened, too. that I live comes to mind. Waking up in Bridger every day, my parents brought a house near our home in Los Alamos to be closer to us. But I felt broken. Fear was no longer thrilling, just scary and everywhere. At night, I grabbed Turin in my sleep because I insisted she was falling and I needed to catch her. I struggled to walk in the woods without seeing something slither. Maybe you just see the world like the rest of us always have, one friend suggested. Maybe, but I miss my old optimism. Instead, I feel sad, grateful, dazed. I want to know whether I did something wrong to deserve my fate. Maybe I violated some rule of nature unknown to me. Maybe the bridge would reveal answers only the herpetologist can interpret. Rattlesnake. Hansen tells me emerge in the spring hungry. They spend their summer hunting and head back to the same den in the fall to breed. Hansen and Grasso suspect I was bitten after stumbling onto a den during spring emergence. Finally, we reached the bridge, the exact spot where I was struck. I'd always thought of rattlesnakes as the gentleman's viper, considering enough to warn you before they bite. Mine never rattled. I asked Grasso why, and he says it's not sure. Because the creek had been flooded to the time, he posits, the snake's senses might have been overwhelmed by tremors of rushing water, shaking the bridge. It was probably hunting and unaware of me until I stepped onto its field of vision, and boom. I'm surprised you live, Grasso says, which I hear as, you're lucky to be here. That ledge there, that's my best guess, Marison has, pointing to a shadowy overhang located about 30 feet up a slab of sloping granite where he imagines the den might be. Garrett turns to me. You want to check? Yeah, I say, trying to sound bold. When I reach the ledge, I peer into a dark crack and see a mouse skitter across the base of the opening. But no snakes, and I feel very lucky indeed. And there's a picture of him 9 days later with his wife hugging him. He has a walker, still black and yellow and badly swollen, but I needed help to walk, but I was alive. And with that, we're going to switch over to the Consumer Reports. Now, this is interesting enough. I know most of our listeners don't drive, but there are people who drive, and they're familiar with cars, a lot of them. But there's several articles in the auto issue for Consumer Reports that comes out every year since 1938. Been around a while. And there's one of the articles is Making the World Safer for Pedestrians, which I think is probably very pertinent to all of us, whether we're visually impaired or not. On a cold, crisp Virginia morning, engineers and technicians watched as a BMW SUV approached from the far end of a test track. As a pedestrian dummy moved across the road on a pulley, the vehicle slammed to it at about 25 miles per hour. The dummy's legs flew off as the force of the collision finally flung the rest of the body up and over the SUV. Even the auto safety experts gasped. Welcome to a typical morning at a new kind of testing job. One focused on reducing pedestrian deaths. The track at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, IIHS, near Charlottesville, Virginia, is a key test facility for systems that help cars see and brake for pedestrians. IIHS, funded by insurance companies, believes that by assessing and publishing special pedestrian detection scores for different models, it can push automakers to improve the performance of their software, sensors, and algorithms. The hope is that the pedestrian detection system will evolve to the point that one day they can reliably save pedestrian lives, even the drivers don't notice someone crossing the street in front of them. Auto safety experts have been increasingly alarmed by the rising number of pedestrians killed by vehicles over the past decade. Some of the traffic deaths have been declining, but the number of pedestrians fatally hit by vehicles has gone up over time at an increasing rate. In 2009, there were 4,109 such deaths, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA. By 2017, it was 5,977, a 45% increase. That's probably because of cell phones. Given the gains made by other areas of road safety, pedestrian deaths really stand out. In 2007, they were 11% of all traffic fatalities. In 2017, they were 16%. Automakers have invested a lot of time and money making safer the drivers and passengers are safer than ever, says Jake Fisher, Senior Director of Auto Testing at Consumer Reports. Now it's time for the industry to do a better job of protecting those who walk along our roads. Pedestrian detection systems are an innovation that's quickly making its way into new cars. They're standard at about one-third of new vehicles and available as an option on about 30% more. Automakers are increasingly putting this feature into the automatic emergency braking AEB systems, to prevent deaths and reduce the severity of injuries, even when human drivers can't or don't react quickly enough. As more pedestrian detection systems arrive on the market, it's crucial that the technology does what it claims to do. IIHS has found that some work works better than others. Building on those results, we've changed our car scoring, starting with this print issue, to give credit to vehicles that have standard pedestrian detection systems. This adds even more incentive for automakers to make them more widely available. Sierra gives credit to vehicles that offer effective safety systems as a standard equipment. Models no longer get credit for city speed, AEB, systems that work at lower speeds as opposed to highway speeds, unless they include pedestrian detection. That's because pedestrians are most often struck on roadways with speed limits below 40 miles per hour. With all traffic safety concerns, there's more that contributes to pedestrian deaths than the vehicle and safety system design. There are human factors such as a growing distraction of electronics for drivers and walkers, and poor road design when it comes to accommodating pedestrians, among other problems. The issues that plague pedestrians aren't new, says Heidi Seedham, deputy director of America Walks, a nonprofit group that advocates for pedestrian-friendly policies. Poor street designs, improper speeds, and culture that prioritizes cars over people have created a landscape that continues to unnecessarily endanger the most vulnerable users of the public rights of way. Perhaps it's obvious, but experts stress that speed makes a big difference. When cars collide with people in the U.S., the average risk of severe injury to a pedestrian increases to 90% at an intersection speed of 48 miles per hour from just 10% at 17 miles per hour. Slowing cars down before a collision is crucial. Reducing speed even a little can be beneficial in terms of fatalities and the seriousness of injuries, says David Ayler, director of active safety testing at IIHS. The more speed you're able to scrub off, he says, the more likely a pedestrian is to survive the impact. Of course, it's not just about surviving. Clearly, avoiding crashes in the first place is the ultimate goal. The moment flesh and bone impact with steel, it's a bad, says David Friedman, Vice President for Advocacy at Consumer Reports. This is why pedestrian detection is so important. Why deaths are rising. Safety experts, including those at the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, point to several factors contribute to the increase in pedestrian fatalities and drivers. Pedestrians and infrastructure share the blame. Drivers can be distracted by smartphones and other technology, but walkers also can be absorbed with their smartphones and not pay attention as they cross a street. Alcohol is often discovered in pedestrians and motorists when there is a fatal crash. Poor urban and suburban planning makes matters worse, says groups such as American Walks. Weak street lighting, not enough crosswalks, higher than necessary speed limits have been cited as risks for pedestrians. On top of that, the unforgiving structure of SUVs, when compared with the lower profile of cars, is adding to the death toll, according to IIHS research. Higher-riding SUVs and other light trucks, which now account for almost 70% of U.S. vehicle sales, up from nearly 50% a decade ago, mean that pedestrians are more likely to be hit by the abdomen or head than at the legs, which leads to more serious injuries and fatalities. As with other new crash avoidance technologies, features that were first offered as pricey options on luxury vehicles are now trickling down to less expensive vehicles. Honda, Subaru, and Toyota are among the automakers that offer pedestrian detection systems on less expensive models that work with low-speed AEB. According to IIHS, 79 of the 109 models currently offered in the U.S. with standard AEB also offer technology to detect pedestrians as standard equipment. 20 of the other 30 offer pedestrian detection only as an option. Automakers that offered AEB with pedestrian detections should be commended. But if the systems were required on every new vehicle, even more lives could be saved, says William Wallace, a senior policy analyst with Consumer Reports. Some consumers might not choose to pay more for pedestrian detection, especially because the safety benefit isn't specifically for drivers and passengers. Lives shouldn't be jeopardized by an auto company deciding that safety is optional or forcing car buyers to pay extra for the technology as part of a luxury package, Wallace says. The federal government has taken steps in the past to get involved. In 2015, NHTSA proposed adding pedestrian detection devices to the battery of tests it runs under its new car assessment program. Despite its early activities, the agency has generally not followed through with action since then, leaving large non-governmental groups to push the industry to improve in this area. Still, as promising as the pedestrian detection systems are, they have shortcomings. There can be false positives when the car sees a person who isn't there. And sometimes there are misses when a system doesn't sense a person when it should. Consumers should understand that current vehicle technology can only assist in driving and doesn't replace the need to pay attention, says Alex Epstein, Director of Transportation Safety at the National Safety Council, a nonprofit that has been working to reduce preventable deaths since 1913. There are extra set of eyes and ears, and sometimes they'll intervene, but they're not foolproof, Epstein says, of vehicle safety systems. You really can't rely on them for now and the foreseeable future, if you have to drive and be the best driver you can be. Moving the industry forward, IIHS research shows that pedestrian detection systems could prevent or reduce the severity of about two-thirds of single-vehicle pedestrian crashes and prevent 58% of related deaths. A 2017 IIH analysis using data from the insurance industry found that a Subaru vehicles equipped with the automaker's EyeSight crash avoidance system, which detects pedestrians, had an injury claims rate that was 35% lower than vehicles without it. Because of that, it's time to make this feature standard equipment in today's new cars, says CR's Fisher. It's important for automakers to expand use of this technology, he says, because many of the serious low-speed accidents can now be prevented. IIHS has created a new ratings program for the pedestrian detection system. Its tests focus on whether vehicles can detect a dummy in three scenarios that duplicate the most common types of crashes involving pedestrians. Cities also work to protect walkers. Cutting down on pedestrian deaths isn't just about improving cars and driving. A 2016 NHTSA analysis found that a higher percentage of those deaths occur in the cities, 76%, and on open stretches of road, 72%, than at intersections, 18%. There's also significant numbers of fatalities at night. Better road design is a cornerstone of the Vision Zero movement, which has been embraced in places such as New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. The goal is to eliminate all road deaths, not just bring the number down. Some cities are taking a close look at the data on pedestrian deaths and considering policy alternatives that are sometimes controversial. Boston saw immediate traffic safety improvements after officials lowered the speed limit in the city to 25 miles per hour from 30 miles per hour. Vision Zero cities are also making investments in raised curbs, better crosswalks and signals, and pedestrian islands. They're implementing road diets by reducing the number of travel lanes on major streets, which reduces the number of cars that pedestrians have to encounter when walking across. A couple of recent innovative approaches stand out. To reduce distracted walking, Honolulu passed an ordinance in 2017 that lets the police give tickets to pedestrians who are looking at their phones when they're crossing a street. That's good. In Detroit, pedestrian fatalities dropped after burned-out streetlights were replaced in certain areas, underscoring the role that poor visibility can play in these crashes. But the politics of lowering speed limits or cracking down on drunken or texting walkers isn't easy, says Epstein. It's a very difficult area to move the needle. Folks who drive don't necessarily want to drive slower, he says. Folks who walk don't want to put down their cell phones away while they're walking. The truth is, to have a safer roadway environment, everyone has to give up a little bit of something. 76% of pedestrian traffic deaths happen in urban areas. The most deadly cities for pedestrians? Number one is Phoenix, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Oklahoma City, Dallas, and Detroit. Least deadly cities for pedestrians? Seattle, Fresno, California, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and New York City. Where pedestrians are hit? 18% at an intersection, not at an intersection, 76%, and then 10% at other places. When pedestrians are hit? At dawn, 1%. At dusk, 2%. During the day, 22%. At night, 75%. 50 to 54-year-olds have the highest rate of pedestrian traffic deaths, although all age groups are at risk, national statistics show. Percentage of deaths when alcohol is involved. though drunken driving is top reason for driver and passenger fatalities. Statistics also show that one-third of pedestrians killed in accidents were legally drunk. And let's take a look at some recalls. The 2010 to 2017 to Toyota and Lexus models. Toyota is recalling approximately 1.3 million vehicles as part of its Dakota airbag inflator recall. Models included are the 2000 to 2013 Toyota Corolla and Matrix, 2010 to 2015 Scion XB, 2010 to 2016 4Runner, 2011 to 2014 Sierra, and 2010 to 2012 Lexus ES350, 2010 to 2013 IS250 and IS350, 2010 2014 ISF, 2010 and 2015 IS250C and IS350C, and 2010 GX460. Dealers will replace either the front passenger airbag inflator or airbag assembly at no cost to owners. Hyundai and Kia models, 2011 to 2015. Hyundai and Kia are recalling more than 168,000 vehicles because a high-pressure fuel line may have been damaged, misaligned, or improperly adjusted during an engine replacement procedure under a previous recall. That could allow fuel to leak, increasing the risk of fire. This action includes vehicles with a 2.4-liter four-cylinder engine that had their engines replaced as part of a 2017 recall. The vehicles included the 2011 to 2014 Hyundai Sonata sedans and a 2000 and 2014 Santa Fe sports SUV. 2011 to 2013 Kia Sportage SUVs and 2011-2014 Optima sedans and 2012-2014 Sorento SUVs. Dealers will inspect the connection line between the high-pressure fuel pipes and the fuel pump outlet. If a fuel leak is detected, they will replace the fuel pipe and properly install a new one at no charge. 2015 to 2019 Ford models. Ford is recalling 410,289 of the 2015 to 2019 F-150 and 2017 to 2019 F-250, F-350, F-450, and F-550 Super Duty pickup trucks equipped with an engine block heater. Water and contaminants may get into the heater cable splice connector, causing corrosion. When the heater is plugged in, prolonged corrosion could cause a short, increasing the risk of a fire. Don't really have to worry about that around here. Dealers will inspect and seal the black heater cable or replace it as necessary free of charge. Volvo models, 2017 to 2019. Volvo is recalling 17,548 of the 2017-2019 S90 cars, V60, V60 Cross Country, V90, and V90 Cross Country wagons, and the XC40, XC60, XC90, and SUVs. A software error may result in the vehicle being unable to provide location information to emergency personnel in the event of a crash. Dealers will update the software free of charge. Toyota Tacoma, 2018-2019. Toyota is recalling 44,121 of the 2018-2019 Tacoma pickup trucks because improper manufacturing of the brake master cylinder may lead to a damaged seal that could affect brake performance and increase the risk of a crash. Dealers will replace the part free of charge. Volkswagen models for 2018-2019. Volkswagen is recalling 73,545 of the 2018-2019 Atlas and Tiguan SUVs and 2019 Jetta cars that do not have keyless entry. The instrument cluster may not provide an audible warning to let the driver know that the key is still in the ignition when the door is open. What to do? Dealers are reprogramming the instrument cluster free of charge. Well, we've just got a little under 4 minutes to go. So rather than starting a whole new article of lengthy time and have to cut it in half, let's do this genius section from the Reader's Digest, Teach Your Brain New Tricks. There's four of them, but we'll probably only get to one of them. The average person's brain contains 80 billion neurons and trillions of synapses. All those brain cells mean your mind can do so much more than you think, as such as seemingly impossible feats. Memorize anything. Say I ask you to memorize the list of 10 words, ladybug, comb, oatmeal, lawyer, coal, stamp, knife, worm, bell, and lettuce. You normally have to repeat them in your head many times before you achieved 100%. recall. Even after accomplishing this tiring feat, a few hours later, you probably remember only two of the three words from the beginning and end of the list. That's because of what cognitive psychologists call the primacy and recency effect. Information at the beginning and end of a series interferes with recall information in the middle of the series. This difficulty stems from the limitations of our verbal memory, the linguistic portion of our brains, where we store arbitrary lists, words, and limited storage. However, our visual brains have vastly more storage than our linguistic brains. Thus, when you store information visually, as opposed to linguistically, you can recall it much better. That's the secret to remember the 10 words above. Instead of repeating the words in your head, convert them to images, and not just any images, but extremely vivid pictures. Then visualize your house and mentally place the image of each object on the list in a different room or a distinct location, such as a closet within the house. For instance, place a very large ladybug, say 3 feet in diameter, and make it really vivid, where the welcome mat would lie by the front door. Then deposit a large orange comb on the floor just inside the front door. Continue to place each success object on the list throughout your house, preferably in the order you would take someone on a guided tour. When you're done, take another stroll through your home and see the objects you left in different places. You should have no trouble visualizing each and every object, and thus each and every word. You can use this same trick to memorize strings of numbers, letters, symbols, or anything else. Just convert what you're memorizing into something meaningful. For example, the number 2 might be presented by an image of you and your spouse. Why aren't women charming anymore? It makes sense that we associate certain adjectives more with women, such as maternal, than some more with men, gallant. A surprising finding at a Stanford University study of language and gender is how much our associations have changed over the past century, and how much they haven't. The research examined databases of books, newspapers, and online sources to see which adjectives were linked to most often with which gender. In the first half of the 20th century, adjectives such as intelligent and logical were associated more with men, but the words have increasingly been associated with women since the 1960s. The most common word to describe women in the 1910s was charming, but by the 1990s, it didn't even make the top 10, but tidy did. And with that, we've run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to become a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thanks so long until next time, and thanks for listening.